Okay, yeah, we've got our whisk, we've got our grater, we've got pitchers of wine and cream and sugar and some lemons.
That's Frank Clark, supervisor of historic foodways at Colonial Williamsburg, with the ingredients for a dessert drink that was very popular in the 18th century, syllabub. We met him just before Christmas in the governor's palace kitchen to talk about the eating habits of the colonists. He's going to show us how to make syllabub, but we also wanted to know more about the role food played in the early years of our nation. Clark says the meal on the table reflected the class of the diners. The wealthiest class included the governor, other palace residents, and their guests.
The key here is variety. Only poor people have one meat, or no meat. If you're the royal governor, as a general rule of thumb, you should have a meat and a side for each guest at the table for the first course and for the second course. Those are the two main courses. Then there would be a very light dessert course consisting of candied fruits and nuts and jellies and jams and syllabub, which we'll get to in a little bit. But two very large courses and then a light course at the end.
And then the gentry class, what would they eat?
The middling sort are going to go and try their best to follow the example set by the very wealthy, but of course cannot afford to put out the kind of quantities that they are. So more meat and potatoes kind of a menu as such in the middling sort household.
And if you were poorer, what would you do? Just end up with a one-pot meal?
One-pot meals, exactly right. Most folks, if you look at the cooking equipment in their household, they have one cast iron pot and that's about it.
However, all colonial Americans, regardless of class, had one thing in common. They loved to drink, not water. That was considered unsafe. Alcohol, on the other hand, was thought to cure the sick, strengthen the weak, enliven the aged, and make the world a better place. Beer and hard cider were very popular, as were drinks with such names as Rattleskull, Bogus, Toddy, Flip, and, of course, syllabub. Right. So, syllabub, where do we start?
Well, you start probably with the lemons. What we'll need to do is grate the outer rind off of our three lemons. We'll just do that on the big grater here. Get as much of that lemon rind.
Frank Clark says food played a leading role in the social lives of 18th century Virginians, and an elaborate feast at the governor's table sent a message.
Well, it shows your wealth and it shows your hospitality. Even at the royal governor's household, he is paying for this food out of his pocket. So if you were lucky enough to get an invitation and he's putting out all this food, it's a clear indication that he wants you to be happy.
It must have also been a place where people could get together and just talk. A social occasion was also for information too, correct?
Absolutely. This is where you get your news. And as a guest or diner at the table, it is your responsibility to provide entertainment for your fellow guests. You don't go there to shovel food in your face and sit there. You do that, you'll never get another invitation to the governor's again.
We're sitting in front of a giant hearth. Was that the main source of heat for your cooking?
Yes, the cooking was done in this household at the royal governor's house by European cooks. The very, very wealthy in England hired French cooks because they were considered the best. So they brought their cooks with them from England. When they got here, English folks and French folks, for that matter, had never cooked on a wood fire. By this time, wood is gone. On a little island like England, there's no longer available. So their fuel has changed from wood to coal or charcoal or peat. So when they come to Virginia and they see a wood-burning fireplace in this kitchen, they change it. They put in a grate that holds charcoal. They put in a stove that burns charcoal. And they set this kitchen up to be just like their home kitchens back home so that they can prepare the same kinds of cuisine and dishes that the governor was used to at home.
There's a crackling fire burning in the kitchen's hearth, keeping us warm, while Frank Clark shows me how to make syllabub.
Now what we're going to do is simply add our white wine.
Okay.
And equal portions in this case, about a pint of each.
That's
German,
two cups of
they
wine.
Call this Rhenish wine, Rhenish wine, because it comes from the Rhine, Valley in Germany. So German white wine there, and then about two cups of the cream as well. And you want to use a heavy cream. this is not a health dessert. This is a holiday dessert, okay? And then the recipe can call for, well, there are about 12, 14 different versions of syllabub, but it can be up to a pound of sugar that's added in.
A pound of sugar?
It can be up to a pound of sugar.
The lemon begins to curd the cream.
Exactly right. It's the lemon juice and the alcohol in the white wine that is curdling the cream. And so what we're going to do is simply stir it. We'll stir this for about maybe 5 to 10 minutes. As we stir it, it's going to start getting thicker and thicker and thicker. And you'll be able to feel it. Let's get you on there. Whisk away there for a minute.
While Frank Clark hunts for one of the syllabub recipes, I whisk the ingredients together. Now, there is no anachronistic mixer or metal whisk in this kitchen. I'm working with a bunch of small birch branches that have been tied together with twine. Everything in the governor's palace kitchen, the copper pots, iron pans, and ceramic pitchers, are handcrafted reproductions of what the 18th century chefs would have used.
You know, we live in an age, you know exactly how much time it takes to make something. How did they do it here?
Experience.
Yeah.
It's your experience that tells you the food's done. Even today, the buzzer goes off. You don't pull that right out of the oven. You open it up and you look. You shake it around. You poke it. Whatever you do that allows you to realize that it's finished and it's ready to go. And they did the same thing all the time. The difference is we put things in our oven and then we go off and do something else. 200 years ago, you were not leaving this room. You're watching those things as they're baking, so you're always there. It's not a set it and forget it. It's a constant watching. But if you look at the recipes of the 18th century, they almost never give times because time is only relevant if you know the temperature, and we're not using thermometers. So if you look at a cake or a baking recipe, they'll describe the oven temperature in terms of speed. A quick oven, a moderate oven, a slack oven, high, medium, low. What you're going to do is you're going to stick your arm into that brick oven after it's been preheated, and you're going to feel the heat level. Now, no one can stick their arm in an oven and tell whether it's 350 or 375. So we forget all about Mr. Fahrenheit and his little temperature scale and think about ovens in terms of heat levels.
Are there special dishes that would have been prepared during the holiday season?
Not so much yet. The idea of a particular meal for a particular holiday is really a very late 19th, early 20th century occurrence in our country. There are a few things that did sort of mark the Christmas season in 18th century Virginia. One of them was a piece known as a rich cake. And the rich cake you can really think of as our fruit cake of today. And they will have a pound cake base. Just about all your cakes start off as a pound cake, which is, of course, a pound of flour, a pound of butter, a pound of sugar, and a pound of eggs. And then to that, we're adding candied fruit, peels, candied nuts, spices, brandy to create this rich cake. You also see a recipe for something called a Yorkshire Christmas pie. Down in the South today in America, we have a dish called a turducken. You may be familiar with this. This is a series of birds stuffed into each other. The same thing with the Yorkshire Christmas pie. It's actually seven different animals deboned, stuffed, and then put into each other, and then placed into a giant, very hard coffin shell and baked. In Virginia here, surprisingly enough, one of the things we see consistently mentioned at Christmas time is rockfish. Of course, this is the time of year where the rockfish come into the bay to spawn. So they're available and you would be catching them and eating them for Christmas at that time as well.
By this point, the curdled lemon cream is pretty thick and my arms are getting pretty tired. Frank Clark says if I whisk too much, I'll end up with lemon butter. Thankfully, he tells me to stop.
So yeah, well, that looks pretty thick and good consistency. Now what we're going to do is pour this into the glasses. What'll happen is over the next couple of hours, this is going to separate out. Mm-hmm. And what you'll do is you'll have a foam on the top that you eat with the spoon and the white wine below. Do not refrigerate it. You have already, if you refrigerate it, it takes forever to separate out. You've already curdled the cream by adding wine and lemon juice in it. So there's no point in keeping it in a refrigerator now. You're making a cheese here. This is an intentional cheesing of the cream. So if you sit out on the counter, in fact, the recipe for everlasting syllabub says to sit them out for up to a week, and they get better as they age.
So you just eat this and then...
And then you drink,
and drink it,
the punch bowl?
And exactly then you're very
right.
happy.
Right? Exactly right. In fact, that's what happened to Little Miss Muffet. You remember her?
She was sitting serving,
eating her curds and whey. This is curds and whey. Any milk, solid and liquid, is considered a curds and whey. That's why she saw the spiders. Too many syllabubs and all that wine, you know, got to be careful.
Poor Little Miss Muffet.
Well, that's the point of the rhyme, is to remind your parents that your children are drinking alcohol. They drink it every day. It's safer than water, right? But you don't want them to have too much, or they'll start seeing spiders like Little Miss Muffet.
Frank Clark is the supervisor of historic foodways at Colonial Williamsburg. You can watch a video of Frank making the syllabub at our blog, npr.org/soapbox. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Happy New Year. I'm Leanne Hansen.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Right before Christmas, I met up with Carla Hall at a Safeway supermarket here in Washington, D.C. Carla is a well-known caterer in this area, but you might know her better as a finalist from Season 5 of the TV show Top Chef. And we gave Carla Hall a challenge. We wanted her to make something using a seasonal vegetable, and it had to include ingredients that could be found in just about any supermarket, and it had to be something easy enough to make for dinner, say, after work. And so, what did she come up with?
I'm going to make a cream of cauliflower soup.
Cream of cauliflower soup. Okay,
yes.
Why are you making cream of cauliflower soup?
Well, one, I love pureed soups.
Yeah.
Two, cauliflower is in season. And we always think of it being around because we have...
It's always around.
Because it's always around.
Yeah.
But it's actually grown at this time of the year, and local farmers are growing it.
Carla says you want to look for a nice, bright white cauliflower without any black splotches. The rest is pretty easy. A carton of chicken stock, some leeks, garlic, fresh thyme, butter, cream, and a few staples from the pantry like salt and flour. Now, don't worry if you missed that. All of this is at our website, npr.org. Anyway, we spent about $21.80, and that will make enough soup for about 10 people. I asked to be Carla's sous chef, so back in her kitchen, she sharpened a santoku knife for me.
Okay.
All right. And put me to work on the leeks.
So we're going to get... While you're doing the leeks, I'll work on the cauliflower. I like that little squeaky sound. You know, when they're really fresh, they squeak.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I love when you do cauliflower like this. You just cut it straight down.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And then you can grill them.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's so yummy.
It's like a cross
section. Why didn't I do that for... I know.
Yeah.
It's like the heart of the cauliflower.
Yeah.
All right, we're looking good. So you have your leeks all cut up and they're washing. You're agitating them in the bowl.
Now, I do a lot of cooking with leeks, but here's a trick I didn't know. Carla Hall says don't wash them first. Chop them up and then throw the chopped bits into a bowl of room temperature water. Swish them around a bit and watch as the sand and grit sink to the bottom of the bowl. The clean, chopped pieces of leek float right to the top. Meanwhile, back on the stove...
We're basically making a roux.
Right.
But we're going to cook
the
leeks...
Which is butter and flour.
Butter and flour. But we're going to cook the leeks in the butter.
Okay.
And then we'll sprinkle our flour over and just kind of do it in the same step.
Okay.
Okay. And if you really think about this soup, it's, think of it like a potato leek, you know, cauliflower leek. Mm-hmm. I know.
Like a warm vichy squash, right?
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. The leeks bubble in about half a cup of butter over low heat. You want to hear them sing, but not brown. Just get them soft. And you want to add a clove or two of minced garlic.
So I would like for you to just sprinkle a little bit of salt in the leeks now.
Okay.
My whole theory about that is if you don't, if you salt in stages, you don't end up over-salting at the end.
As the leeks cook down, Carla sprinkles a bit of flour on them. This will help thicken the soup later.
It smells really good. Okay, so we don't want to rush anything.
Yeah.
Good soup, good food takes time.
Right.
And even though this soup will be done in about 30, 35 minutes, okay, let's call it 40.
Yeah.
We need to take all that time. So they're looking good. That butter is frothy and yummy. Mm.
Now, let me ask you this question. I know you're a fancy, famous chef and all. How much do you cook at home?
Not too much. My husband cooks.
Yeah.
I lay on the couch while he's cooking.
Yeah.
Because when I get home, I'm like, I'm really...
You're done.
Yeah, I'm done. So I want to add in our cauliflower that's been chopped, yeah?
Yep.
And all the little bits that fall on the cutting board are going to go right into the soup. As you are making the soup, be present and let the process be a little organic and not be so rigid with the recipe, because you have to feel it. For instance, if I'm doing this soup in season, the cauliflower is in season, it's going to taste totally differently than it would if it's not in season. You have to honor the produce. Maybe you have to add something else in it.
Right.
So I think people need to think about that when they're cooking.
And so... basically, I mean, the soup, at its core, I mean, the soup is just cauliflower, leeks, and it could be olive oil and some chicken stock.
Exactly.
I mean, you wouldn't have to add cream or butter or flour if you didn't want to. I mean,
Nope.
That just makes it taste better.
It does. But it looks so good. Oh, my God, I'm so excited. I can't wait.
All right. So looks like the soup's ready, Carla. I think we're starving.
Right. Yes.
Once the cauliflower chunks are nice and soft, Carla ladles everything into a blender and pulses it to a silky smooth texture. Then it's time for lunch.
That's delicious.
You like it?
This tastes like a fire, a warm fire inside on the sofa, wearing a Snuggie.
Right. I want one of those.
Wear your Snuggie and eat this soup.
Yeah.
And... winter will be perfect.
Yeah.
Carla Hall is chef owner of Alchemy Caterers in Silver Spring, Maryland, and she was a finalist on season 5 of Top Chef. You can find the recipe for Carla's cauliflower soup at our website, npr.org. Carla Hall, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.